We all wake up from dreams where faces and places and events seemed all jumbled up and we tried to make sense of them. What did that dream mean? Our guest this hour writes of asking the same questions of indicators in our real world, in our waking hours. Do they mean something? Robert Moss is the author of Sidewalk Oracles, Playing with Signs, Symbols, and Synchronicity in Everyday Life. Prepare to get your mind expanded. Robert Moss is a novelist, poet, journalist, and scholar, and a former lecturer at Australian National University in Canberra. He's the creator of Active Dreaming, both the concept and the book by that name. Home is now in upstate New York, though he's on the road about half the year. Robert Moss, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Good to be with you, Jeffrey.
So you call yourself a dream teacher and admit there's no career track for it. So what is it?
Well, you know, we've forgotten how to dream in our culture. Of course, people have dreams, but they don't know what to do about them. We've lost a way of talking about dreams, which made sense and rewarded people for bringing a story to the breakfast table. So part of it is giving people a way to talk about dreams that provides helpful feedback and guides them towards action on an everyday basis. Part of it is remembering and teaching people that we can travel into other states of reality and other states of consciousness safely. We do it at night, whether we intend to or not. We can learn to do it as lucid dreamers. We can learn to do it by making journeys as the shaman does in the workshops. We use drumming for that. And also we can learn to become dreamers in everyday life by reading the world around us as a set of signs and symbols that might contain guidance and give us a clue as to a deeper order of reality. So as a dream teacher, I help people in all those ways. I help them to harvest information, guidance, energy from the night. I help them to travel consciously or lucidly into the dream space. And I help them to recognize that, as the Aborigines, my native Australia, say, we live in a speaking land where everything is communicating if we'll pay attention, and we can find those signs and symbols in the world around us, too.
So a couple of terms I want to get a handle on before we move further into talking about sidewalk oracles, which is active dreaming and lucid dreaming, two terms you've mentioned already. What are those?
Well, active dreaming is a description. It's a provocative one. I invented the phrase because it's meant to shake us out of the idea that a dream is simply something that happens to us. Yes, we do have spontaneous sleep dreams. They may seem crazy, or they may seem mundane, or they may seem to be things that are waking us up to a deeper reality. But dreaming is more than the passive action of the passivity of lying down and having a dream. I mean, a dream may have you, actually. So active dreaming refers to the idea that we can go actively and consciously into the dream world, that we can be active about bringing guidance and information from a deeper reality accessed in dreams into everyday life, and that we can be active as dreamers on the roads of everyday life by reading those signs and symbols. Lucid dreaming is a word that's been used in a number of ways, sometimes sloppily. Today the discussion's been matured. Usually when people talk about lucid dreaming, they mean that you are alive to the fact that you are dreaming inside the dream. You're aware that you are dreaming inside the dream. Now, you might accomplish that by setting yourself up for it. You might practice mindfulness meditation or something like that, become a little bit more conscious of what's going on in everyday life and carry that kind of mindfulness into the dream state. You might start out when you lie down in bed, if you're not exhausted, with the idea that you'll try to remain lucid. You'll let images rise and fall, or maybe set an intention for an adventure and follow it consciously as the dream unfolds. There's a very simple way of becoming a lucid dreamer, which I've invented. I just invented an acronym for it, actually. The acronym is rather fun. The acronym is So Wild. And what it means is you let yourself go to sleep. You're open to what happens during sleep, so that's the so, but you're not laying it on yourself as a burden to bring back dreams necessarily or laying any heavy intention. You wake up after the first cycle of sleep, and we all do wake up, whether you recognize it or not. You wake up after 2 or 3 hours of sleep, typically. You wake up, you might go to the bathroom, and then when you return to bed, you make it your intention to stay lucid and stay conscious. You might set an intention, I'd like to be in a place of healing, I'd like to have an adventure, I'd like to have a fun dream and remember. And then you will yourself to enter a state of conscious dreaming, lucid dreaming, from which you'll remember things and bring back gifts. So that's a simple everyday practice of lucid dreaming. Shamanic dreamers, and this is a shamanic approach, in other words, we use simple techniques like shamanic drumming to fuel and focus journeys into non-ordinary reality. When we're doing that, we're making a shamanic lucid dream, if you like. A whole group of people can do it. In my workshops, 30 or 40 people will get together and make a journey somewhere interesting, powered by shamanic drumming. And it's amazing how fast and how deep the experience can be.
So it sounds like you're generally all about the idea of blurring the lines somewhat, that we tend to think too much about dreams being in our sleep and wakefulness being wakefulness. And there are ways in which they can invade each other's spaces, in a sense, in a good way.
Well, yes, I don't know that I'm terribly enthusiastic about the word blurring, Jeffrey, but I am enthusiastic about the idea that we learn to look at the life around us as a waking dream, and that we learn to look at what goes on in dreaming in other realities as a real experience. In other words, we stop saying the real world is only what we can touch and smell with our physical bodies or test in the laboratory, and recognize that there are real experiences and real orders of reality somewhere else. One of my personal mantras, one of the mantras I made up related to all of this, is this. We need to take our dreams more literally, and we need to take the events of waking life more symbolically. I mean, that puts it in a nutshell. I mean, you will notice as you do more work with your dreams, keep a journal, study your dreams a long time, and learn to talk about them to other people sensibly and get feedback. You'll notice several things about your dreams. You'll notice, for example, that you are seeing things quite accurately across space and time. You're naturally clairvoyant, psychic, precognitive in your dreams, and that's not all that much of a big deal. Most cultures throughout most of human history have valued dreams because they've given survival information. You see around the corner, you see things happening at a distance. So you'll recognize that some of your dreams are literalistic in that sense. You're seeing things quite close to ordinary reality, including things that will manifest in the future. And actually, if you see things you don't like and you get the information, you might be able to choose a better future. Dreams can be quite real in another sense, that they might be experiences of another order of reality. You might go to those hidden dimensions that superstring theorists talk about. You might go to parallel universes that the physicists who are giving us many interactive world theories are talking about. So as a dreamer, you might wake up to the fact you've had an experience which is quite real in another order of reality. This is the kind of thing, once again, that most human societies have valued throughout most of our evolution on the planet. The West lost it for a while. We need to get it back. This is too much fun to fail to do.
All right, we'll start talking about how the West can embrace ideas like that in the book Sidewalk Oracles, Playing with Signs, Symbols, and Synchronicity in Everyday Life. Robert Moss is the author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Robert. You can join the conversation if you'd like. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Moss, Sidewalk Oracles, and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Robert Moss, dream teacher, and maybe the only person who actually uses that title in the world, but there may be others. We'll talk to him about his book, Sidewalk Oracles, Playing with Signs, Symbols, and Synchronicity in Everyday Life. It's about the way that we look at things in our dreams and try to figure out what they mean. We can do the same thing when we're awake as well. Join us on the Exchange with questions, comments, observations of your own, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Robert, how much do people need to let go of the everyday and mundane to appreciate what you're talking about in this book?
Excellent question. And what I would say is that the game is to recognize the extraordinary in the ordinary. So we don't actually have to let go of the mundane. What we need to have to get let go of is our programmed, scheduled, climate of expectations inside our heads, our tendency to go around in headphone land, literally or symbolically, on a certain track in a certain groove, to become a synchronicity magnet in a positive sense, somebody who will attract interesting phenomena, interesting events and encounters spontaneously in the world. You got to be open. If you don't have some magic inside you, you won't find magic around you. But the trick, as explained in the book, is to find the extraordinary in the ordinary, to find the sacred in the profane, to find the numinous, the sense of a power operating in a different reality coming through to you, because you're open and available. So I give people games that you can play anywhere, anytime, on the most gritty urban block in the midst of your day, if you give yourself 5 minutes to be present in all of your senses to what the world is saying to you. One of the games that I invented I call Sidewalk Tarot. Many people listening are familiar with tarot. It has 78 cards. You might get some self-understanding. You might even get a clue to what's happening by reading tarot. Well, the universe, when you're looking for signs and symbols, has a limitless number of cards to deal you. So one of the games that I suggest is, hey, on your way to work or 50 minutes during the lunch break, you've got a question on your mind. Carry that question or theme in your mind and see what the world gives you in the way of an unusual, unexpected pop-up, a symbolic pop-up, an incident coming into your field of perception. Maybe it's a snatch of conversation from a stranger. Maybe it's the behavior of that dog. Maybe it's the flight of that bird. Maybe it's the kid's chalk drawing on the street. you'll find when you start playing these games that magic is all around you. So you don't actually have to absent yourself from the world. You need to be present to it more fully with the ordinary senses and with your inner senses and your intuition than many of us tend to be. Go amongst indigenous peoples whose traditions are alive, like, for example, the Aborigines of the Western Desert in Australia, or traditional Native Americans who are still close to their source, as our ancestors used to be. And you'll find that living in this world is a dreamtime exercise because they're alert to what the tree is saying and they'll commune with the tree. They're alert to what the wind is saying and they recognize that we're an animate, conscious universe where everything is communicating if we'll pay attention. And by the way, this idea is not some primitive superstition, some holdover from an earlier order of evolution. It's what our science is telling us, too. Our science is telling us there's no hard and fast boundary between mind and matter anywhere in our multidimensional universe, and that the dance of consciousness might be at the heart of everything. So to open yourself this way might also be to put yourself at the leading edge of what scientists are thinking about, which is how reality itself operates, how mind and matter interweave. So you might find yourself becoming a scientist of consciousness, gathering data in a first-hand way.
The sidewalk tarot part is interesting. So you basically would, you know, the first thing you would see or hear would be one indication or one card in this play out.
Let me give you an example of how this works, because I love to live and teach by stories, Jeffrey. So I'm walking an urban street with my funny little dog. These days I just have a little 20-pound black miniature schnauzer. He's a love puppy. He's a silly little dog, and I love him. And I'm walking him towards the park, and I have a theme on my mind. My mind is, how can I possibly juggle two projects I've taken on at the same time in the same season? The amount of time and energy involved is huge. The projects are probably mutually competitive, and I'm getting uneasy about having taken on these two obligations. So that's on my mind, and I'm walking the dog. And a big guy, I don't know, gets out of a big truck with a big box of something over his shoulder. He looks at me, he looks at the little dog, and he says in a booming voice, "Well, he can't kill both of us at the same time, can he?" I walk up the street, I've been slightly stunned by this overture from a stranger. I'm thinking, what does this mean? And I mean, I get it. I sort of slap myself on the head at the obviousness of it. I mean, the message is, Robert, you cannot handle the two projects at the same time. The dog can't go for two people at the same time. And I'm thinking, oh, well, I've got to call a guy up now and disappoint him, and he won't be happy. And an hour later, I make the phone call, and this is where the story gets really lovely from my point of view. I'm telling a guy that I'm going to let him down. I'm not going to do a project I've undertaken. And he's disappointed, and he's not happy. And then I say, look, let me tell you the point of decision. The silly dog on the street and the big guy are saying, you can't kill both of us at once. And the guy on the end of the phone starts laughing. He says, Robert, I get it. I get the synchronicity thing. You made the right decision. I would have done the same thing. No hard feelings. All is well. So that's an example of a couple of things that are accomplished by playing the game. First of all, I got direct guidance on a theme that was on my mind. And secondly, I got a humorous human way of communicating that decision that made all well. So that's an example of how it works. And let me note that in the way that I received the oracle from the sidewalk incident, I was doing something that for which the Greeks who valued oracles had a name. One of the kinds of everyday oracles that was valued by the ancient Greeks was what they called the kledon, K-L-E-D-O-N, and there's a little chapter in Sidewalk Oracles about playing the game of listening for your kledon. The kledon is the first words or sounds coming out of silence or the undifferentiated hubbub, the white noise of modern life. You hear some words sailing out of silence or white noise. This, for the Greeks, was often a definite message, and they had a simple ritual for putting a question to the world and then listening for those first sounds coming out of silence. So I got a kledon. I got a kledon from the guy with getting out of the big truck who made a joke about my little dog, and it worked. It was exactly what I needed to hear that day. So that's a sample of finding the extraordinary in the ordinary.
The book is called Sidewalk Oracles. Robert Moss is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange and its author. So I mean, other terminology for this would be looking for omens, wouldn't it?
Yes, looking for omens. And I recommend that people study their personal omens and be quite pragmatic about what works and what doesn't. I mean, I incite people to identify personal omens, not the omen handed down to you from grandma's superstition, or unless it works. You know, don't believe that Friday the 13th is unlucky, or lucky for that matter, until you check out what tends to happen to you on Friday the 13th. So I think it's a great way of becoming someone operating with sidewalk oracles when you conclude that for you, for example, the appearance of a friendly black dog in an unlikely place is a good sign for the day. That's one of mine. I've lived with friendly black dogs much of my life. They're very important in my life. And when they turn up, particularly in unexpected situations, I'm alert for something positive to develop. Another friendly oracle for me, friendly omen for me, is the appearance of a red-tailed hawk. I once changed my life because of a red-tailed hawk, and perhaps I could tell that story briefly.
Sure, yeah.
So this is actually what put me on the road to becoming a dream teacher, for which, by the way, Jeffrey, there are now quite a few people who will use the tag because I train them. I do training.
Okay, now you're not the only one. Good to know.
We actually have people who are calling themselves dream teachers in 21 countries now, but you're right. I probably was the only one at the outset who was using that phrase. Now there are others. Anyway, what put me on the road to becoming the things that I am and doing the things I now do is I decided in the mid-1980s I had to get out of big cities. I was leading a commercial fast-track life. It was successful, but something in my soul was clawing me to live differently. And I found a piece of land in the upper Hudson Valley of New York with a rundown farmhouse, and it felt like a place to be and live close to the land and listen to the animals and the trees. And I'm thinking, but, you know, this, I don't know this part of the world at all. What am I doing here? And I'm sitting under an old white oak tree behind the house, which feels like the guardian tree of the land. I feel close to that oak, as my ancestors would have done. And I'm thinking, there's got to be a sign if this is the right decision to move here. And a red-tailed hawk comes circling overhead, dropping lower and lower, squalling at me in a language I feel I ought to be able to understand. Yeah! And drops a feather between my legs. And I accept this as an unsecret wing brush from the universe, a sign to go ahead. And since then, in many ways, extraordinary ways, the hawk has given me signs, appearing in nature in unusual ways, or simply having a feast on roadkill, which always makes me feel good for the day. And so that's one of my personal omens. And I look to the hawk for guidance, and the hawk turns up in my dreams, particularly in my lucid dreams, where I sometimes feel able to fly like that bird with all the delightful physical seeming sensations of flight. So that's one of my personal omens, and I encourage people to find their own and see how they work. And if you think something is a good sign or a bad sign, fine, but then check it out. See what happens next time it turns up and revise your opinion if it's not working for you as a reliable omen.
Well, it seems like it does work on several levels, though, to be open to these experiences because, I mean, there's certainly a spiritual and shamanistic tradition, if I'm using that term correctly. But also, I mean, I think a psychologist or a counselor would recommend that you be open to new experiences. And so when people comment on your dog or feathers drop out of the sky, that, you know, you can have a sense of wonder about those. And even on a purely scientific level, these are good things for you.
Yes, you put that very well, and thank you for using the phrase a sense of wonder. I think one of the key things you need to carry with you if you're going to do more of this and enjoy it and have that fizz of magic every day is you need to have a sense of wonder. You need to be open to wonder. And if people say that that's childlike magical thinking or magical expectation, well, you know what? You need your inner child with you in life. If you don't have your inner child with you with his or her sense of joy and imagination and wonder, you're missing a vital part of your soul. I mean, as you mentioned, this mine is a shamanic approach. It's not big on ritual, and we don't do hallucinogenics or anything like that. But I'm very big on the shamanic idea that the root of much of our existential difficulty in our lives is what shamans call soul loss. We've lost a vital part of our energy and imagination. Sometimes the energy of that beautiful, bright child of wonder, because the world was too cruel, and he or she went away from us and remained absent from our lives because life was too tough. So shamans recognize this phenomenon of soul loss, and they practice what is called soul retrieval, or what I call soul recovery, which is when we help each other to reclaim aspects of ourselves that have gone missing or have not been recognized and honored in life. So on these roads of this world and of the other worlds, you want to carry the child inside you who has that sense of wonder. And if that child is with you, then you'll have energy and imagination beyond what most grown-ups are capable of.
Robert Moss is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the author of Sidewalk Oracles, Playing with Signs, Symbols, and Synchronicity in Everyday Life. You can join the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange and maybe share some of your own experiences. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And here's an email from Tim in Eureka. Robert, he says, I'd like to hear your speaker address how marijuana may affect dreams or remembering dreams. You just talked about hallucinogens. This is not quite to that point.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the evidence is in that marijuana either assists or diminishes your experience of dreaming. It's certainly not a hallucinogenic, as you know, we might speak about ayahuasca or peyote or other things that people take. I know some pot users who've come to feel that it's interfering with their dreaming, just as some heavy alcohol users might feel that that's interrupting their dreams. I mean, I drink alcohol, and I've noticed that if I've had more than a few drinks on some night, the first phase of sleep dreaming is often not that interesting and the recall is diluted. I know some marijuana users have had the same effect and have cut back or cut it out on certain nights because they felt it was diminishing the vividness and quantity of dream recall. But as I say, I think the jury's out. I'm not convinced that marijuana use, at least in moderation, either impedes or assists the experience of dreaming.
So let's come back to one of the terms you've mentioned a couple times here, and I haven't asked for an explanation, synchronicity, in the sense in which you use it.
Well, synchronicity was a word invented by Mr. Jung, who was a classical scholar as well as a scientist and psychoanalyst, because he got fed up with people's difficulty in talking about meaningful coincidence. And we run into this all the time. People say it wasn't a coincidence when they mean it was, but it's meaningful, not meaningless. So he coined the term synchronicity, which literally, etymologically, just means things happening at the same time. It's a sort of unsatisfactory term because synchronicity is not just about two things happening at the same time, though that's part of it. For example, you've got some thought in your mind and something happens. I'm thinking about the two projects. The guy talks about the dog not attacking two people at once. That's synchronicity in the sense of an inner thought or preoccupation meeting an external event which either mirrors it or maybe goes beyond mirroring it into providing some point of decision, some message. But synchronicity can run in riffs, it can run in series. You can notice the same theme, the same symbol popping up in daily life again and again and again over hours, days, weeks, or even throughout a lifetime. One of the things I encourage people to do is look at recurring patterns and symbols over long periods of time and notice when certain situations are being repeated and take consciousness of that moment. Do you want to get into the old bind or the old decision-making, or do you want to do something different? So anyway, in my vocabulary, in my way of looking at things, we know synchronicity through our inner senses. We know it because we feel it. What we feel is that the universe just got personal. We know it through our shivers. We feel that time is somehow working differently. It's sometimes as if time has stopped, or time has expanded, or something is coming through to us from beyond space and time as we ordinarily understand it. Jung referred to this just once in all of his speech, in all of his lectures and writings, as far as I can establish, in an interview with Mircea Eliade, the great Romanian scholar of religion and shamanism, in 1954 for a French magazine. Jung said, quote, synchronicity, in brief, a rupture in time, a rupture in time. What a pregnant and interesting phrase. I was thinking about that when I came up with a new word, because I like to coin words too. Mm-hmm. I haven't made up as many as Jung did, but I made up a few. I thought about that when I was trying to come up with a word to describe the practice of operating by synchronicity, the practice of navigation. And I thought, a rupture in time, well, that's what it feels like. The Greeks had more than one god of time. They had the old linear god Kronos, god of linear time. They also had a younger god called Kairos, or Kairos, K-A-I-R-O-S, who personifies opportunity time, the special moments when time works differently, it stops or expands, and you have the moment when you should jump or seize an opportunity. So I thought, okay, Kairos, the god of special moments. I put his name together with Mansi, which is about divination, and I came up with the term chiromancy. Chiromancy is the art or science of divination, of getting messages from special moments. And if you do this well, you become a chiromancer, which sounds romantic, sexy, mysterious, all the above. I haven't met anybody so far who doesn't want to be a chiromancer when invited to consider the possibility of living like that.
Well, so how do you practice this? And by the way, I have to notice how many different fields you draw from. You actually get from Carl Jung to the Tao in one paragraph in the book. But so how does one practice chiromancy then?
Well, it starts with being open. We were talking about that earlier. You start by being open to experience. You start by taking off the blinkers, and that involves, you know, some peripheral vision, right? You're open to what the world is giving you. You're not just going to assume that it's all laid out on that linear roadmap. Number two, you are accessible and available when things start to work differently. Number three, when you feel that it's a special moment, when you're getting a sign or symbol from the world, you're willing to say thank you. I mean, you might even feel you're being pushed back, but you say thank you because something is coming through to you from a deeper order, and then you take action. You take action. I lay out 12 rules for living as a chiromancer in the new book, and one of them is terribly simple. Everybody gets it right away. The first rule is, everything you think and feel, the universe says yes. if you like, this is the infamous law of attraction, which has been advanced in some rather silly ways. But it's what Emerson, the great homespun American philosopher, called spiritual magnetism. Our energies, our attention, our style draws or repels different things. So if you're going to be a chiromancer, you want to notice how this works. And what that means is you check your attitude from time to time, because your attitude goes ahead of you in life, helping to shape the events and encounters that you will run into. So you check your attitude. You check your inner soundtrack. One of the games I recommend is you pause on a daily basis a few times and ask, hey, when I'm not listening to anything outside myself, what is playing in my head? What is the song? What are the thoughts? What am I saying to myself? What am I repeating internally? Is it bringing me up or down? And sometimes you need to do some station changing, some station surfing or adjustment to your inner soundtrack. So that's one of the rules of becoming a chiromancer. One that people find more challenging is, to put it in the way that I want to put it right now, is for every setback, look for the opportunity, or as I put it more poetically in the book, by what you fall, you may rise. When something goes wrong in your life, it might be as small as a missed plane connection or getting lost in a simple road trip. It might be as big as losing your job or your relationship or suffering an accident or an illness. When something goes wrong, look and see if there is a gift in the wound, if there's an opportunity in the setback, if when one door is closing in your life, another door is opening. It's awfully hard to do when you feel let down and disappointed. But it's a game richly worth playing.
In other words, if you get stuck at the airport because you missed your flight, at least enjoy the sunset you get to see?
Absolutely, and the stranger you might meet because you're there together.
All right, and we have a story like that to talk about that is actually mentioned in the book. Robert Moss is our guest. His book is Sidewalk Oracles. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Robert Moss, novelist, poet, journalist, scholar, and dream teacher, and one of many across the world, as we found out. He is the author of a new book called Sidewalk Oracles, Playing with Signs, Symbols, and Synchronicity in Everyday Life. You don't need to just interpret the dreams you have while you're asleep. You can also interpret the signs and symbols you see while you're awake is the premise of the book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about waiting in airports, and in fact, in the book, you tell early of an airport encounter with a young man. Relate that to us, would you, Robert?
Yeah, and it took place under the sign of the fox, who for me is one of the embodiments of the trickster element in life that comes into play when your plans get scrambled. So I'm changing planes at Washington's Dulles Airport, and I'm looking for a place to sit down, have a sandwich and a beer. I'm straight in, I'll have a beer when I can, and there's nowhere available on that concourse except a woman gets up from a bar stool and says, oh, take my seat, you'll be interested in this young man. The young man is very strange. He's bopping back and forth between the now vacant seat and his own. Finally, he consents to give me a seat, and he's looking at me in a very strange way. And I see the desperation in this young man's face. He strikes up conversation. He asks me to guess his age. I guess his age correctly. And then he says an astonishing thing. He says, I asked for an elder. I believe you are the elder I asked for. And I'm sitting there trying to think what I have to do to be a responsible elder to this young man. And a conversation begins to unfold, which was deeply moving for me. It became very clear very quickly that this young man had just been rejected and abandoned by his family, which is a military conservative Virginia family, probably because he was gay. That was my assumption as I got to know him a bit. He was feeling the loss of his father, who was a military officer. So I talked to him a bit about my relations with my dad, who was a military officer, and how we became great friends in the years before his death, for which I was very grateful. After he died, and he remained a friend to me in my dreams, actually. So the conversation's going deep and profound, and the young man's sobbing. And he asks me what I can advise him about life. Well, I say, well, don't leave the sense of humor at home. And I tell him a few other things, and the conversation, and he wants to pay for my lunch. I won't let him, of course. He wants a hug. I give him a hug. And I know at the end, I'm getting shivers as I tell this to you. I know at the end of that encounter that I have been blessed by being cast in the role of the elder this young man asked for. He needed a man, an older man, with some knowledge of life, to sustain him and to support him and to tell him a few simple nostrums or principles about life that he was longing to hear, and to talk to him about the possibility of healing relations with the Father. And I walked away from that thinking, well, sometimes chance encounters feel like a lot more than chance is involved. And on this occasion, it wasn't for my benefit, it was for his, though, of course, I got a story out of it. And I felt blessed by that opportunity we sometimes get to do some good for a stranger, to be cast as the everyday counselor, the everyday angel, even, that they are needing. So that was something that happened at an airport where conditions weren't horrible, but they weren't great, and I was given that opportunity. Later on in the book, I tell some really wild stories about other adventures at airports, sometimes facilitated by missing the connection, and at work in all of them is some kind of mysterious magnetism or gravitation that brings strangers together in unlikely ways because they have exactly the information or the gift for each other that one or both of them need to exchange.
We certainly make opportunities for ourselves. I mean, if you just decided to sit down at the bar and read a book and say, don't bother me, to the guy next to you, it would have been a very different sort of situation.
That's true, although that would have been difficult to do with this guy.
But earlier, Robert, you said that attitude helps shape events.
Yeah.
Does it shape events or does it shape our responses to events?
Probably there is no real distinction between the two ideas, Jeffrey. I think that our response to our events and the events themselves are intimately entangled. I mean, there's an entanglement between them. So I'd say that it actually shapes both. I think there's evidence. I mean, there's scientific evidence. There's evidence satisfactory to physicists that our thoughts and emotions actually shape physical reality around us. They don't create it 100%, but they influence it. The people's thoughts and emotions can have an effect on the behavior of material things as well as other people's minds. Certainly, mind reaches to mind. We humans are in a field of constant interaction, in a mind field, and our energies spill over each other. But the key, to come back to your real question and give a better answer, at least a more direct answer to it, we always have the ability to choose our attitude and choose our responses, and that can change everything. And to go deep and dark for a moment, whenever I think about that, I think of Viktor Frankl, who gave us the extraordinary book Man's Search for Meaning, a survivor of Auschwitz, who found that in the ultimate nightmare of humanity may be reduced to a skeleton with a tattoo who can be tortured and killed by anyone, anytime. He exercised the freedom to choose his attitude. He pictured himself in a world after the Nazis had been overthrown, in a world where there are no concentration camps anymore, giving a lecture on the psychological lessons of the concentration camps to a well-fed audience in a New York auditorium. And 1 year after the war, having survived, he inhabited that vision, giving that lecture to that audience in New York City. That's an example of the power of choosing your attitude. We always have that freedom. So let's exercise it. Even under the worst of circumstances, those are almost unimaginably horrible circumstances, we can choose our attitude, choose our response, and that can change everything in terms of our personal experience of the world.
Boyd in Wolf Creek takes us back to omens in his email. He asks, does it matter whether omens come from a monotheist interventionist god, or can they be random, and can we benefit simply because we are in the moment?
Well, I don't think it probably does matter, but there are choices beyond a monotheist one god's hand at play and randomness. I mean, we live in a thickly populated universe. I mean, the view of ancient and indigenous peoples that everything's alive, that a tree spirit can interact with you, and that there are many forms of the sacred and many forms of other powers between the humans and any singular deity, is one that I'm naturally sympathetic to. I guess I have a naturally animist view of life, in the sense that for me, as for the Aborigine, the world is spirited. The world is alive and conscious. So, events that come up in this way can be wild, but for me, they're never exactly random. I'm not talking about predestination or fate. I don't want to buy into any idea that things are predestined.
And no large guiding hand or anything?
No, I don't want. There's a phrase in German for the experience of coincidence, synchronicity. They talk about the fingertips or the fingerprints of fate. So I'm in favor of noticing the fingerprints and the operations of the fingertips of larger powers, and to be receptive to the idea that there is a hand that would like to guide us. But if I don't like the way it's guiding me, I'm not going to go along with it without exercising as much free will as possible. In other words, this is very much a free will approach. We're going to choose our day. We're going to make our choices and take the consequences.
We have a call here from Peter in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Moss, the author of Sidewalk Oracles. Peter, go ahead.
Hi there. Yeah, I've also had an experience with a red-tailed hawk. It was very transformative for me, and I really like the idea of the teacher being, you know, the universe itself, and finding signs in nature. On that regard, I was listening to some talks by a Sufi master, and he was talking about the archetypal realms and how we really lost contact as a society with the inner reality or the imaginal world, so we don't carry that inside of us anymore. And it kind of reminded me of that. And but I try to look for signs in nature, and my wife has passed recently. But right before she got very ill, there was a white owl appeared to me.
Yes.
I mean, a real owl showed up on the way to work. And, you know, I called her. I warned her about the girls. I said, keep an eye on them and call your mom and check everything. And within a couple of days, she was sick and in ICU. And right after she died, the day she died, an owl landed on the power line.
Oh.
And as a kind of a completion.
Yes, I'm so sorry for your loss, Peter. The owl, as you've come to understand, and as traditional wisdom teaches us, is a remarkable ally and guide in relation to death and dying. And appearances of the owl can portend such things, can confirm such things. They can also create a relationship with the owl of a shamanic or visionary nature, which can make us ourselves, maybe you yourself, something of a guide and something of a helper in relation to these areas. I mean, the owl is an impeccable guide when it comes to looking into dark and difficult things, including death. And thank you for following the red-tailed hawk. And thank you for the comment about the archetypal realms. I mean, part of this approach to synchronicity that I practice and teach is that we are alive to what I call the mythic edge of life, or if you like, the archetypal edge. We are alert to the larger story and the archetypal energies that are at play on the edge of our consciousness, and we're willing to recognize when those larger forces are with us and how to operate in concert with them. That is a huge subject, and it's part of what I enjoy living every day. Thank you so much for your comment.
Absolutely, Peter. Thanks for the call, and I'm sorry to hear about what's been going on.
Yeah.
Let's see. Debbie and Talent, short email. She wants to know what your theory on deja vu is, Robert.
Oh, I love deja vu. Please study what's going on. I used to say that although we call it deja vu, which in French means already seen, it's often the experience of déjà rêvé, which means already dreamed. We a dream is manifesting. We may not remember the dream, but we recognize something because a dream is manifesting around it. And I think that is an explanation for many of our experiences of déjà vu, but I think there can be other things going on as well. We may have come to this place before. It might be something to do with a past life. It might be something to do with a parallel life. This becomes very interesting. In the book, I've got a chapter on déjà vu, and it really encourages people to look at it in a number of ways, including with the question, wait a minute, do I know this situation because I was here before, in the sense that maybe on a parallel event track, in a parallel world, I got ahead of where I am now and came here ahead of myself. If that sounds wacky, it becomes less wacky when you study it in the context of your everyday experience. So studying and noticing and thinking about what goes on in déjà vu is a great exercise in studying the nature of reality and consciousness themselves.
Another call here from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Moss.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the story about the young man in the airport. I have recently had an encounter with a young man in my life, and it has been very life-changing. And the operant key word in it is tactile.
Mm.
And all sense is tactile,
mm-hmm.
including the visual, and we're enmeshed in it, and we can't get out of it, and we can't get into it. We're just in it. And the way that you speak makes sense of it all so far what I've heard. And you have used the word oracle, I guess, in your title, and I have been using the I Ching recently, and you'll see, if you look carefully at the use of the I Ching, that it's very tactile and deeply involved in, along the lines of the quote that you just made from the German wisdom.
Yes. Thank you so much, Carter. Let me comment on your description of the I Ching as a very tactile approach. It indeed is. Let me just give you an example of how far this can reach. I was teaching a course in I Ching. I'm not an expert on I Ching, but basically I taught a year-long course in order to learn it because it's a fascinating oracle, as you suggest. And I was getting ready to jump in my car and drive down to the place where I taught some many miles away. And I've taken to casting the I Ching with the coins because it's simple and the arrow stalks are complicated and time-consuming, etc. The coins fall out of my little bag and they roll across the surface of my desk as if I'm casting them, but I haven't. And they fall in a pattern, so I cast them until I've got the six lines of the hexagram. And I look at the pattern and I look at the changing lines. And in summary, the message I've got, as if the coins themselves decided to speak for the oracle of I Ching before I chose to consult them, the message I've got is a hexagram that is sometimes called limping, and the detailed commentaries say difficulty on the road, slow down, take a detour. That's the sort of practical conclusion you would make. I think, oh, well, I better be careful in this class. I take it symbolically. I'm careful in the class. Don't go too fast. On my road home, I've forgotten about the I Ching, and I run into every motorist's favorite dream, a state trooper, and I get a ticket because I'm driving too fast and failed to take a detour I could have taken to go by my old home, which I considered. So the I Ching gave me the message for the day. I received it in this spontaneous and very tactile way, but then, drat it, I forgot it by the end of the day.
So it really, it sounds like what we're really getting down to here ultimately is paying attention to what is going on around you. And I mean, you can choose to interpret it a number of different ways, though.
Sure.
There's no single interpretation for anything you
see. No single interpretation. You know, I was giving a course recently which involved studying some traditional Australian Aboriginal practices from one of the oldest cultures on the planet. And I was commenting on how Aborigines in the Western Desert, people like the Kukucha, when they're sharing dreams within the family around, you know, while cooking breakfast, boiling the tea, they insist that nobody really is going to tell a dreamer what their dream means. The dreamer gets to understand what's going on through practice, practice, practice. You recognize your own language. Okay, you've got a special kind of dream going on involving ancestors or sorcery or some stuff like that. You go to an expert for certain problems. But in relation to dreaming in general, you are required to become the expert on your own dreams. And this is the attitude I take. Yes, I'm a dream teacher, but I'm not going to tell you what your symbols in waking life or anywhere else mean. I'm going to show you how to develop symbols for yourself and become the master of meaning, the author of meaning for your own life. Now, practice, practice, practice.
Practice, practice, practice with Sidewalk Oracles. That's the name of the book. It's subtitled Playing with Signs, Symbols, and Synchronicity in Everyday Life. Robert Moss wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Robert, thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Good to have you here.